reconvene. We undertook a very comprehensive site visit this morning, both in terms of the walking over the subject site, but also travelling around the environs of the racecourse site. So that was actually helpful in terms of more fully understanding on the ground the nature of the location of the proposition, and also the adjacent industrial areas, residential activities, etc. So we'll now turn to the council, and in particular Mrs. O'Dwyer, your section 42A report and presentation, and also hearing not just from yourself but also any of the witnesses you may wish to call. So over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and commissioners. We have prepared addendum reports to our original 42A reporting, just to comment on the matters raised in evidence and make further recommendations if appropriate. So the technical specialists will go through their addendums, and then I will follow up with the planning addendum after they have all presented. So they'll go through in turn, and obviously are available to answer any questions that you may have. So we'll start with, we've got Ian Smith, who is covering stormwater.
Which is a where are we? Appendix 5, yes.
Sorry, but yes, the order of speakers doesn't quite match the appendices.
Okay, that's fine.
Thanks.
Mr. Smith, take us through your statement, please.
Thank you. So this addendum provides, as was stated, further assessment from matters raised and the evidence from the original review that myself and Greg Cumming prepared. I've been involved in reviewing this application for some time, since the original sort of 2018 draft of things. So this addendum covers the stormwater aspects only, whereas Greg will cover the wastewater side of things. So the information that I considered in this was built on the back of the subcatchment ICMP by Wainui, and primarily it's the evidence from Mr. Fink, but also some comments were made by Mr. Campbell and Mr. Liggett of Kaimakura around some issues related to stormwater, so I've touched on those, and also yesterday a statement was made by Jay McNally around some drainage.
Yep.
And so we offered some clarification to those as well, from my opinion. So I clearly understand and read the code of conduct. By way of my own background, which is not listed here, I'm a civil engineer with a Bachelor of Environmental Engineering, Chartered Professional Engineer, from 1999 is when I graduated. So my background is 23 years in stormwater and flood assessments, and I've reviewed many applications for HCC, including peer reviewing 6 or 7 of their catchment citywide models, and doing some of those models myself. In terms of the review of evidence, I've reviewed the design elements relating to stormwater, the subcatchment ICMP has been a bit of a process since the original in 2018, where HCC, Wainui, and Becca, the company I work for, sat down and reviewed the issues that we first raised and gotten to a conclusion. And so that subcatchment ICMP is a reflection of that process. So I consider that there's no outstanding technical issues in that subcatchment ICMP, but there are a few things that were raised in evidence in this hearing, which is what I'll cover now. So there is a planning issue related to where flood hazard and flood hazard mapping should sit in the district plan. I understand what Kyangal, the representations made by Mr. Campbell and Mr. Leggett direct to, but I consider that really a planning matter. So I won't offer any comment on that and will really defer to council's statutory administration of that issue. It certainly is, flooding certainly does change rapidly, and council have mechanisms to deal with that, like what Mr. Leggett mentioned in terms of GIS. I can clarify the representations made by Jade McNally in the hearing, refuting part of the subcatchment ICMP, that she maintained some of the racecourse land does drain onto 89 Garnet, and by inference the neighbouring property as well. That's correct. Some of the land does drain that way. But Mr. Vink in his evidence mentioned that the flow path is in the opposite direction. They're both correct. And I'll just set out my justification of that. So the racecourse land does fall that way. You can tell that from the contours. The property, 89 Garnet Ave and 6, and by association 6B King Brown, is in a localised low point in the topography. So water not just from the racecourse will drain to that point, and it forms a basin. And so that basin's contained by surrounding elevated land, and once it gets full enough in a very severe event, that it would overflow back over the racecourse land and flow that way. And those severe events are usually what council will consider in an overland flow path assessment. And you can see the images of that basin and the subcatchment ICMP in the flood maps. So in the frequent, regular, everyday rainfall, yep, it would drain onto that property. In the severe events, it would fill up and overflow in the opposite direction. So, in a sense, they're both right. It just depends what level of event you select and you consider. So further to that if the development does proceed, it will bring with it regrading of the site and a drainage system which would divert that land currently draining onto that property into the wetland and away from that property. So in that sense, there'll be a benefit in the day-to-day drainage of lesser events. There's still the 100-year overflow scenario. That water, of course, will still be routed to the wetland, proposed to be attenuated and released. So as part of that overflow, and that in those severe events, there's been discussions made in the hearing around the potential for an acoustic wall. So that would need some care, depending on its configuration, its arrangement, not to block that overland flow path. So there remains an issue that needs to be resolved, depending on whether that is a requirement coming out of this hearing. So you would look at evidencing your flood risk and your flood effect in a resource consent hearing. That's where you do the detailed modelling and improve it. And that would be associated with an equivalent design development as to where things would sit, where a wall might go, where it might not go. And so that would be an appropriate place to address that issue, which is really why, in the end, I conclude that the issues are addressed for a plan of change hearing. So in my conclusion, I say that there are currently no technical issues, and with a acoustic wall does eventuate, there's an issue there that will need to be resolved with later design and modelling. And that's also what the ICMP says, that needs to be detailed modelling and a resource consent to show that. So I think that's consistent. And so therefore I confirm that the statements in the Section 42A report, or I reconfirm the statements in that report, that the applicants appropriately got measures in place to address stormwater effects.
Thanks, Mr. Smith. Questions? Councillor Donovan.
Not at this stage. Mine was addressed through the submission. Thanks.
Yep. Commissioner Behe.
No, I concur with my colleague. I totally take the point that it's that level of detail when we get to the subdivisional stage, we'll sort out the fine grained detail. I totally take the point. So thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Okay.
No, I don't have anything, so thank you.
Yep.
Mrs. O'Dwyer.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We now have Ms. Collier to discuss water supply, and you will find her appendix, her addendum as Appendix 4.
Welcome, Ms. Collier.
Kia ora.
You can take us through your statement.
Thank you. Thank you. So, as stated in the addendum, this provides just further assessment and comment on the plan change following review of the applicants and submitters' evidence. My full name is Jacqueline Marie Collier. I'm the Strategic Waters Infrastructure Unit Manager here at Hamilton City Council, and I'm authorised to provide this on behalf of Hamilton City. I hold a Bachelor of Natural Resources Engineering with honours and have over 20 years' experience in environmental engineering, strategic waters infrastructure planning and development, working in and for public and private sectors. I've been employed by Hamilton City for 7 years and have had several roles in that time, including infrastructure engineer and strategic manager of infrastructure. And in my current role, I'm responsible for managing the strategic planning for three waters infrastructure that identifies investment needs and informs, amongst other things, the three waters asset management plans, the 10-year long-term plans, the 30-year infrastructure strategies, and also supports evaluation of development proposals. The information that I've considered in preparing this addendum, because I have come in to replace Isaac McIntyre, who was the person who provided the advice in the Section 42A report. So in preparing this addendum, I've reviewed the subcatchment ICMP prepared by Wainui Consultants, the specialist report prepared by Mr. McIntyre, the statement of evidence by Mr. Vink, and also the letter from Fire and Emergency New Zealand. I can confirm that the way that I've approached this evidence is in the same manner as I would if I were preparing evidence for environment court proceedings, and have complied with those requirements in the Code of Conduct. So just in summary, in terms of the applicant's evidence, I agree with Mr. Vink's response to the water supply matters raised by FENS in their submission in paragraphs 49 and 50 of his evidence. In terms of submissions that related to water supply, FENS were the only submitter on matters relating to water supply, and I consider that the explanations and responses to these submission points included in the Section 42A report are appropriate. FENS have tabled a statement accepting the explanations provided by Hamilton City in response to their submission points, which you have in front of you. And just in conclusion, I agree with the conclusions from Mr. McIntyre included in the Section 42A reporting, specifically that the modelling completed to support the plan change is still fit for purpose, and further modelling is not required to support the plan change, that Hamilton City are not aware of any current network, water network constraints, but a thorough assessment would need to be undertaken to support subdivision consent applications at development stage rather than at this plan change stage, and that Hamilton City imposed conditions to subdivision consents requiring that the public water network is designed to conform with the code of practice for firefighting water supplies, which is in accordance with our regional technical specifications. I did want to add a few points to Mr. McIntyre's technical report, just noting that the conditions that I've just referred to are intended to ensure that the public water network meets council's requirements for vesting assets. I also note that in addition to the district plan triggers, council are currently in the process of reviewing our water network connections approval process, which we have the ability to enforce through our bylaw and the Local Government Act, to also require that public networks provide for minimum firefighting standards as prescribed in our regional technical specifications are met as part of approving new connections to our water supply networks. I'll take any questions.
Commissioner Beattie.
No, I think, just like Mr. Smith, I understand it's, we'll get down to the detail with the, when we get to the sub, if we get to the subdivision. Thank you very much.
Councillor Donovan?
No, I'm good, thanks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't have anything either, so thank you, Ms. Collier.
Thank you, Ms. Collier. We now have Mr. Alistair Black, who is going to discuss transportation, which is Appendix 1 to the
We're happy, Mrs. O'Dwyer, in terms of if Mr. Smith and Ms. Collier wish or need to depart during the course of the afternoon. So, given we didn't have any questions for them, so I just wanted to highlight that opportunity. Welcome, Mr. Black.
Good afternoon.
Over to you. If you can take us through your statement, please.
Thank you. I propose to start at section 2 of the introductory bits and pieces. Mr. Balachandran discusses the impact of rezoning one lot from major facilities to industrial zone. It is unclear whether his assessment has taken into account trips that could be generated by activities permitted by the current major facility zoning. I agree with Mr. Balachandran that trip generation of industrial activities at the site is likely to be small. In my assessment, industrial activities could generate 6.5 to 16 vehicles per hour. This is based on a site area of 1,400 odd square metres and assuming a site coverage of 50% and a trip generation rates of 0.9 to 2.2 trips per hour per 100 square metres GFA. So while higher than the trip generation calculated by Mr. Balachandran, I do support his conclusion that the additional trips are likely to have a negligible effect on the safety and efficiency effects. So just the first point there on the major facility zoning, we've both just talked about if this was industrial, but there is a level of permitted activity that could occur. It is major facilities, but when I look through the list of activities, they're quite, for the racecourse major facilities, it's hard to see those sorts of things establishing in terms of having a really small site with some horses on it or whatever it is. So I haven't attempted to quantify what that permitted level of trip generation is. Mr. Balachandran discusses the proposed footpath on Ken Brown Drive and recommends that a raised safety platform be provided across Ken Brown Drive. It is not the intent of my review that the footpath be provided on the western side of the road. A transportation review noted that a footpath on the west side would allow pedestrians to cross Minogue Road, which has a lower traffic volume than Garbutt Ave, would provide more direct access to Minogue Park, but would require tree removal. I support the amended provision of 4.8.12c, which does not specify which side of the road the footpath is to be provided and requires a raised safety platform be provided across Ken Brown Drive. In my view, the location of the footpath and raised safety platform can be confirmed at the time of resource consent. In response to Sabina's, Mr. Balachandran discusses the impact of the development as it relates to on-street parking on Ken Brown Drive and Sir Tristram Ave. In his primary evidence, Mr. Balachandran addressed parking demand based on rates from Waka Kotahi's research report, 453. Prior to changes required by the NPSUD, the district plan required on-site parking for industrial activities at a rate of one space per 150 square metres GFA and one space with 40 square metres GFA for offices. The following table provides my assessment of the three sites against the previous district plan requirements. And that demonstrates that if those minimum requirements were still in place, those activities would comply. I agree with Mr. Balachandran that these three sites appear to provide sufficient on-site parking for typical industrial activities based on typical parking demand rates and the previous district plan requirements. Mr. Balachandran and Mr. Hall differ in their measurement of the carriageway width. The regional infrastructure technical specification defines the carriageway as measured from the face of curb face to curb face. I've measured this width as 8 metres on both Ken Brown Drive and Sir Tristram Ave. As no stopping is already marked on one side of Ken Brown Drive, there is 5.9 metres available for vehicle movement at all times. This assumes a parking bay width of 2.1 metres. In my view, the extent of no stopping lines does not require any changes on Ken Brown Drive. Currently, the only parking restrictions on Sir Tristram Ave are short lengths outside the childcare to protect visibility for vehicles exiting that site. My recent observations align with Mr. Hall, and that on-street parking was only occurring on the northern side of the road. I did observe a number of vehicles parked on the southern berm at the eastern end of the road that did not appear directly related to Fairview Motors. In my view, it would be prudent to mark no stopping lines on one side of Sir Tristram Ave to reflect current parking behaviour and prevent inappropriate on-street parking, reducing the available carriage to less than 5.5 metres. Currently, parking is only occurring on one side of Sir Tristram Ave. In my view, marking of no stopping is reinforcing current parking behaviour. I consider the access benefits of maintaining two-way traffic on Sir Tristram Ave outweigh the potential loss of parking, noting that parking is only occurring on one side of the road. I consider that marking no stopping on the northern side of Sir Tristram Ave would improve visibility of the existing vehicle crossings and potentially provide more parking due to the absence of vehicle crossings on the southern side of the road. I note that the proposed district plan provisions do not include any requirements relating to no stopping. As discussed in my review, any changes to on-street parking requires changes to HCC's traffic bylaw and involve consultation and decision making through a separate local government act process. In my view, the extent of any no stopping restrictions will be considered as part of future LGA and resource consent processes once a consent application has been lodged. The purpose of the race safety platform and signalised crossing of Taraba Road is to make walking and cycling more attractive and improve access to public transport, which is consistent with national, regional and local transport objectives to improve road safety, reduce emissions and support mode shift. I agree with Mr. Balachandran that the safety benefits from providing improved crossing facilities on Taraba Road and the service lane outweigh loss of on-street parking spaces. Submitters have raised concerns about the potential lack of parking within the future residential development. In accordance with the NPSUD, the district plan no longer requires a minimum level of parking to be provided. I addressed this in my transportation review. In my recent experience, only a small proportion of dwellings are provided without any off-street parking spaces, and I consider the risk of no off-street parking being provided as low. Just sort of expanding on that point, I'm currently reviewing a couple of consent applications for the council and Peacocks, and both of those applications, the applicant has suggested a condition that says we will provide X off-street parking spaces, you know, typically averaged across a lot or a development area. So there may be some that have no parking, but there will be others that may have multiple parking spaces as well. So I guess that this sort of aligns with the comments that Mr. Hall made yesterday in terms of, you know, most of the developments he's seeing are providing some of the parking on site. The proposed local road cross-section width is consistent with the decision versions of Plan Change 5 and the notified version of Plan Change 12. And in my view, there is no reason that on-street parking cannot be provided as part of residential development within the Plan Change area. In my experience, medium density developments can provide 0.3 to 0.5 on-street spaces per dwelling. I consider it as appropriate for the provision of on-street parking to be confirmed as part of future resource consent processes. Mr. Hall discussed no stopping on Ken Brown Drive and Sir Tristram Ave. I've responded to these points earlier in this statement. In my view, additional no stopping restrictions are only necessary on Sir Tristram Ave and reflect current parking behaviour. Mr. Hall states that raised platforms are typically constructed with a total length of 6 metres as discussed by Mr. Balachandra, this is incorrect. Regional infrastructure technical specification shows the typical full width from raised pedestrian platform. It's a total of 7.25 metres. I agree with Mr. Balachandra that no stopping lines are required at the raised zebra crossing, but note that the Waikatahi sign guidance states that 6 metres is the minimum length, 15 metres is desirable. In my view, the extent of no stopping can be confirmed as part of detailed design. Future resource consent processes to balance the need for visibility between pedestrians and drivers and the parking impact. I consider that the benefits of providing a safe pedestrian facility across the service lane outweigh the effects from a small loss of parking spaces. The loss of parking is limited to parking necessary to support a safe pedestrian crossing of the service lane into Rapa Road. No changes are necessary on Ken Brown Drive, and marking no stopping on one way on one side of Sir Tristram Avenue reflects current parking behaviour and is necessary to maintain two-way traffic. I do not consider any further mitigation of parking effects as necessary. Mr. Hall considers that development should retain access to Main Street Place and potentially remove access to Sir Tristram Avenue to avoid safety effects at Sir Tristram Ave to Rapa Road intersection and avoid removal of parking on Sir Tristram Ave. In his rebuttal, Mr. Balachandran does not support this for safety, capacity and directness reasons. I do not support providing vehicle access to Main Street Place as it would require residential trips to travel through the major facilities and industrial zones to reach Rapa Road. I consider the mixing of industrial and residential trips undesirable from a road safety and function perspective. It would increase the traffic volumes on Sunshine Ave approach to Tarapa Road roundabout, which Mr. Balachandran states already experiences average delay of 86 seconds per vehicle in the PMP. The removal of all vehicle access to Sir Tristram Ave would result in slightly longer trips to and from the north, and is likely to increase trips along Ken Brown Drive as the left in from Tarapa Road will be removed, and trips approaching from the south are unlikely to travel via Main Street Place. Removing the right in from Tarapa Road may result in an increase in U-turns at the Tarapa Road Garnet Ave signalised intersection if this is perceived by residents to be more direct or shorter than the street place. Proposed signalised crossing and existing signalised intersection at Home Strait provide gaps in the northbound traffic flow for the right turn into and left out of Sir Tristram Ave to occur. Mr. Hall states that it is my opinion that it is unlikely that this intersection will ever be upgraded in the future. I disagree with this statement. The recommended program of the Hamilton Waikato Metro Spatial Plan Transport Program business case identifies Tarapa Road as part of the RT1 route for implementation in years 10 to 15. I understand this is likely to result in a transformation of Tarapa Road and intersections along the RT1 corridor to support bus priority and bus rapid transit. Mr. Hall is concerned about the impact of additional signalised intersection on Tarapa Road and identified errors in the modelling. Mr. Day expressed concern about the proximity of the proposed signalised crossing to the existing signals at Home Strait. The proposed signals will be separated by around 130 metres. By comparison, signalised intersections on Anglesey Street are as follows. So between the car park access out here and down to Ward Street is 120 metres to the signals. The next signalised intersection up is 100 metres away. And the next one is 240 metres. So there are examples elsewhere in the city on busy four-lane arterials where there are closely spaced signals, and the team at the operations team has sort of demonstrated the ability to be able to manage those at peak times. I agree with Mr. Balachandran that the safety benefits for pedestrians and providing improved access to public transport are likely to outweigh efficiency effects, and agree that delays can be minimised through coordination with the Home Strait signals. I know that traffic will only be stopped when a pedestrian activates the crossing phase. I consider the signalised crossing provides wider benefits to staff and visitors to developments on Home Strait. The current and consented office activities on Home Strait have significant workforces, and the signalised crossing improves access to public transport service on Tarapa Road, which is part of the RT1 route identified in the transport program business case. Several submitters raised concerns with delays and crashes at the service lane exit. Since 2018, there have been no reported crashes relating to vehicles turning into or out of Sir Tristram Ave or the service lane. So just to be clear, that we're not saying there haven't been any crashes. The database captures reported crashes, which is when a police officer attends and submits a report through that system. So if there's been a fender-bender accident and both people exchange insurance details and go on their way, that won't be recorded in the system. So the system is really good at recording fatal and serious accidents because the police and ambulance and all sorts of things turn up, but non-injury crashes are quite often very underreported. So there may be crashes happening there, but the focus of road safety at the moment is on serious and fatal injuries. And so that's why we're sort of focusing on where we can manage or reduce the effects of serious and fatal crashes. We're not worried about trying to resolve every road safety issue so nobody bumps into each other. The proposed changes to this intersection mean that vehicles exiting the service lane only have to give way to vehicles entering Sir Tristram Ave. They would not have to give way to vehicles exiting Sir Tristram Ave, but those vehicles can only turn left out. The proposed layout modifies the alignment of the exit to Tarapa Road to improve driver visibility and should improve operation of the intersection. I've reviewed the revised modelling provided by Mr. Balachandran. I agree with him that the effects on right turn and U-turn movements at the Tarapa Road Sir Tristram Ave intersection are acceptable. The image here is the proposed layout, just to help with the understanding of paragraph 3.12, so just there as a reference tool. Mr. Hall is concerned that the proposal relies on alternative routes to avoid long delays at the Garnet Ave Tarapa Road intersection and the potential for safety effects of these other intersections. In his ITA, Mr. Balachandran assessed the potential increase in right turn movements at the Garnet Ave Tarapa Road intersections, 54 vehicles per hour in the morning peak and 30 vehicles per hour in the evening peak. I consider the impact of the additional traffic on the Garnet Ave Tarapa Road intersection in my transportation review. Note that figure 6 of my transportation review only considered alternative routes to Tarapa Road and does not show other urban connectors that could be used for travel to and from the west and south, which includes employment areas at Frankton and Waikato Hospital. The figure below shows the transport network in one network framework, demonstrating there are multiple routes available for travel to and from the site that avoid intersections on Tarapa Road. So in that figure 2, the orange blob is roughly the plan change area, and then the light blue corridors are the urban connector routes in that area that do demonstrate there are alternatives to turning right out to Tarapa Road, depending on where your ultimate destination may be. I agree with Mr. Balachandran that there are a few options to address the potential efficiency effects of this development at this intersection, noting the implementation of bus priority and or bus rapid transit medium to long term will likely result in changes to this intersection. I agree that the primary mitigation is to encourage alternative modes to reduce the number of vehicle trips. Should residents choose to drive, I consider that there are suitable alternative routes available and the level of increase across multiple routes is unlikely to result in noticeable effect at other intersections. I confirm the conclusion of my earlier transportation review that from a transportation planning perspective, the location and transport connections mean that residential activities are consistent with the transportation objectives and policies in the ODP and Hamilton Strategic Framework. I've considered the transport effects, and in my view, they are addressed by the proposed plan provisions or can be addressed through future consent processes. I support the amended Rule 4.8.12c, requiring a road safety platform on Ken Brown Drive, as attached to the evidence of Mr. Oliver.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Black. Councillor Donovan, in the first place.
I do have a question, and you may have to forgive me, Mr. Black, because I'm a bit of a newbie here. But we talked about, what was it? I think it was 86 seconds waiting time. Can you just, probably more for my benefit than more than anything, just give me some clarification around what that means? Is that cars stopped waiting for 86 seconds to get out, or is total time in a queue?
So including the time in the queue, so compared okay. to that's across the hour, vehicles are experiencing 86 seconds. So it's taking you 86 seconds if you're trying to leave Sunshine Ave to get through the roundabout and get out of here.
Oh, yeah. And that's averaged out, is it?
Yeah.
Yep.
So, okay. So at some points of the hour it may be longer,
yeah,
and other parts of the hour it may well be shorter as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's all at this stage, thanks. Yep. Thank you.
Commissioner Beattie.
No, thank you. Very, very clear and understand. Thank you very much.
I don't have any questions either, Mr. Blake. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mrs. O'Dwyer.
Thanks, Mr. Blake. Next up we have Mr. McGregor commenting on acoustic and the sensitivity matters.
Appendix 3.
Yeah.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. McGregor.
Thank you.
And over to you if you can take us through your statement.
So I'm Peter McGregor, the Council's Environmental Health Manager. We've had over 30 years' experience in reviewing applications for resource consents and designations involving noise emission, including reviewing acoustic assessment reports. Also been involved in numerous investigations of noise emission from industrial sources, including the Parents and Environment Court. That's not in the addendum, but I thought I'd just introduce myself. So in this addendum, I cover evidence of Mr. Bell Booth, Mr. Jacob, and evidence from two submitters yesterday, Murray Berica Binden and Suzanne O'Rourke, representing Fonterra. If I start at paragraph 2.1, in his evidence in chief, starting at paragraph 30, Mr. Bell Booth describes further noise monitoring carried out of ambient noise within the Taraipa Racecourse site during June 2023. The additional measurements confirmed that the current acoustic environment has not changed since the previous 2017 and 18 measurements. The measurements serve to describe the current ambient acoustic environment to provide context and to confirm that noise emission from existing industrial activity would be able to comply with the proposed 65 dB LAEQ 15 minute limit in Rule 25837E within the proposed residential precinct. Noting that there is no existing limit on noise emission from the nearby industrial activities into the racecourse property, being a major facility zone, referred elsewhere as a gap in the ADP noise rules. So paragraph 3.1. Mr. Jacob states a concern in paragraph 52 of his evidence that the Marshall Day acoustic assessment dated 19 July 2022 is based on the existing acoustic environment rather than what could potentially occur in terms of permitted levels, although acknowledging that the proposed changes to the noise rules are reasonable despite this, at least during the daytime hours. As stated in paragraph 2.2 above, the assessment of the current ambient environment provides assurance that noise emission from the current level of industrial activity would be able to comply with the proposed 65 dB limit. LAQ 15 minutes, Mr. Jacob has pointed out in paragraph 21 of his evidence that the noise descriptor used in proposed rule 837E does not include the reference time interval of 15 minutes that is used in most other noise-related rules. This needs to be corrected, so the limit should read 65 dB LAEQ 15 minutes, and to confirm, this applies at any point within the proposed residential precinct. This would be consistent with other provisions in the Hamilton District Plan, for example, Rule 25837C. Paragraph 3.4, Mr. Jacob has pointed out in paragraph 22 of his evidence that the proposed exception from Rule 837A would also exempt the targeted industrial activity from complying with the default noise limits in relation to the Forest Lake Retirement Village. I agree that this is an unintended outcome of the proposed rule and should be corrected. Mr. Oliver, in his evidence, has proposed a change to Rule 837A that would remove the proposed Te Rapa Racecourse medium density residential precinct from coverage of this rule. I agree that the proposed change would address the issue. The next heading, Commissioners, should read nighttime adverse noise effects. and in paragraph 3.7, Mr. Jacob in his evidence has raised two issues in relation to potential nighttime adverse noise effects, sleep disturbance from industrial activity. Impulsive noise and low frequency noise are represented by the 63 Hz and 125 Hz octave bandwidths. Examples of activities that give rise to impulsive noise are detailed in paragraphs 30A and 33 of Mr. Jacob's evidence. Paragraph 33 describes impulsive noise. Examples of activities that give rise to low frequency noise are detailed in paragraph 40 of Mr. Jacob's evidence. I agree that these types of noise have the potential to cause sleep disruption during nighttime. It is submitted by Mr. Jacob that the best practicable option to mitigate effects from these types of noise is to increase the building setback to 60 metres or to construct an acoustic barrier at the industrial zone boundary of greater dimensions than the currently proposed 1.8 metre acoustic fence, and also, with reference to low frequency noise, to impose internal noise performance standards for the proposed residential precinct in relation to the 63 Hz and 125 Hz octave bandwidths. And I discuss each of these in the following paragraphs. Low frequency and impulsive noise. Rule 25.8.3.10 requires any noise sensitive activity, which includes residential activity, located within an industrial zone, among other zones in certain transport corridors, to comply with the internal noise design criteria in 25.8.3.10e. The criteria do not include anything in relation to low frequency noise or impulsive noise. Conversely, the Hamilton District Plan has low frequency noise limits that apply to and within the Tiara Lakes Business 6 zone in that rule, and to event type noise at certain venues in that rule that must be met within residential zones. There are also low frequency noise limits in Chapter 25.3 temporary activities that apply to activities within certain zones or spaces and must be met within residential zones. The LEQ limits apply only during nighttime and are 70 decibels at 63 Hz and 65 dB at 125 Hz, except for the Tiara area where they tend to be lower. These are all external noise limits imposed on the noise producing activities and are intended to control base beat noise from concert type events. The accompanying LEQ 15 minute levels are 75 dB for event type noise and 55 dB in the Tiara area. Notwithstanding that Rule 8310 is silent on low frequency and impulsive noise received in habitable spaces, I considered that it would be necessary to include consideration of protection from nighttime low frequency and impulsive noise, particularly when considering the proposed limit of 65 dB LEQ, which is between the LEQ levels of 55 and 75 quoted in the previous paragraph. This would mitigate reverse sensitivity effects raised by submitters in the event industrial activity increased to a greater level during nighttime. Increased offset or higher acoustic fencing. It is submitted that the potential adverse effects on residential amenity and reverse sensitivity of impulsive noise and of low frequency noise can be mitigated by either increasing the building setback from 30 to 60 metres or by installing a 4 metre high acoustic fence along the industrial boundary. The suggestion to erect a 4 metre high acoustic fence on the industrial boundary is the preferred option for the 60 metre setback and deserves consideration in my opinion. It represents the preferred method of disrupting the propagation of noise, which is to mitigate at or close to the source of the noise, which in this case is the boundary with the industrial zone. An alternative option to a fence on the boundary is to construct an earth bund in the open space area. Such a fence or bund would reduce the line of sight from industrial-based noise sources to the nearest residential buildings particularly in relation to habitable rooms and lower floor levels of the residential buildings. It could be constructed with sufficient mass to mitigate, although not necessarily avoid, effects from impulsive noise and low frequency noise. The resulting noise level on the residential side of the fence bund would depend on the level and type of noise emitted by industrial activity. Having a fence or bund would mean less restraint imposed on industrial activity, thus mitigating reverse sensitivity. While a fence or bund would have significant benefits in my view, there would likely be residual noise to manage, and there would be locations along the boundary where the fence or bund may be less effective. For example, in relation to upper levels, in relation to upper levels of residential buildings and or elevated industrial sites or activities. For this reason, low frequency and impulsive noise insulation should also be provided at the building facade. Amendments to the assessment criteria suggested to specifically refer to low frequency and impulsive noise as part of the acoustic design of the buildings. The following assessment criteria amendments are suggested. And so I have reproduced the full assessment criteria from 1.3pc, and the addition is in subclause 2 there, underlined. So starting, so it says that the extent to which noise-sensitive activities within the noise-sensitive area are protected from noise arising from outside the building by ensuring that, 2, the building is designed and constructed to mitigate the impact of impulsive noise and to mitigate low frequency noise at 63 Hz and 125 Hz to a reasonable level. Continuing at paragraph 321, a 4 metre high, substantially constructed fence or bund would also serve to provide a better outdoor amenity, not only within the proposed residential precinct, but also in the greater area, including the open space, which would not be screened by buildings. It has been suggested that such a fence be erected where there are presumably existing noisy industrial operations. In my view, this is a piecemeal approach and is a less efficient way of managing noise when considering the potential for an increase in the level of industrial activity at any one site. There's the issue of who would pay for the construction of new fences in the future when an industrial site becomes noisy. My view is that such a fence or bund should be required by a rule in the ODP to be erected along the whole of the industrial site boundary as part of the planned change. Such a rule already exists in relation to the Ruapura Logistics and Ruapura Industrial Park zones, being 25A3.14B. In summary, a sufficiently high acoustic fence or bund of sufficient mass would be the preferred option to a 60 metre setback and provide relief in relation to the following. A, reduced adverse effects of low frequency and impulsive noise from industrial activity on the residential activity, although protection from nighttime low frequency and impulsive noise should still be considered. B, reduced line of sight to habitable rooms and lower floor areas, resulting in reduced acoustic-related design and construction of the residential buildings to comply with any internal noise design criteria that may still be required. C, reduced constraints on building design and construction, including replacement of habitable rooms within buildings and building orientation. And D, increased outdoor amenity within the residential precinct and in the intervening open spaces. No complaints covenant. It is submitted that a no complaints covenant would be appropriate to mitigate reverse sensitivity. In my view, a no complaints covenant would have no value from a regulatory point of view, I might add, in relation to noise. Such a covenant would not necessarily prevent complaints to council. Any complaint would initiate an investigation to determine compliance with the 65 dB limit, if accepted. Remedial action by an industrial activity is required only where there is non-compliance with this proposed limit. I turn now to the Fonterra submission. Fonterra raised concerns about reverse sensitivity issues in relation to noise emission from their operations, impacting on their operations at their Crawford Road site. Doesn't read quite right, but the nearest distance from the western boundary of the proposed residential precinct to the Crawford site is approximately 450 metres. There is also a large building on their site located between the racecourse boundary at this point and their outdoor yard area, which would act as an effective noise barrier. There is an open line of sight to an outdoor operations area to the south of the building, approximately 600 metres from the residential precinct boundary. The intervening ground cover over the racecourse area is predominantly soft, which would provide additional attenuation of noise over and above the distance attenuation. The distances are similar to the existing Forest Lake Gardens retirement village adjacent to the racecourse. To date, there have been no complaints received by council from residents in the Forest Lake Village or the new Bupper Foxbridge Retirement Village in Minogue Drive, indicating the Fonterra site does not currently emit a level of noise that creates adverse effects at these locations. The existing LEQ limits that apply to industrial activity, including the Crawford Street site, in relation to the retirement village are 50 dB during the daytime and 40 dB during the nighttime, with two short shoulder periods at 45 dB. These same limits would apply in relation to the residential precinct, other than the industrial sites adjacent to the residential precinct. It is also noted there are other residential sites closer to the Crawford Street site, albeit to the west of the site, where compliance with the above noise standards would have to be met. Therefore, Plan Change 13 would not introduce any additional burden of compliance on Fonterra in relation to noise that does not already exist. Murray Verica Binden raised a concern about entertainment areas within buildings in the residential precinct being used for noisy residence gatherings, impacting residents in the Forest Lake Gardens retirement village. Noise from short-term noisy gatherings, particularly where amplified music is involved, would be subject to noise control, as in any other area within the city. Any continuing issues would be dealt with according to well-established procedures, which would include the involvement of anybody, corporate or other property management agency. Conclusion: the additional measurements carried out by Marshall Day Acoustics confirm the current acoustic environment has not changed since the previous 2017 and 2018, measurements. The measurements serve to describe the current ambient acoustic environment to provide context. They confirm that noise from existing industrial activity would comply with the proposed 65 dB limit, noting that there is no existing limit on noise emission from the nearby industrial activities into the racecourse property, being the major facility zone. However, there is the potential for impulsive noise and low frequency noise to cause sleep disruption within the proposed residential precinct at night time at a higher level of industrial activity than is currently observed. The LEQ noise descriptor used in the proposed rule 837C should include the 15-minute reference time interval. The wording of the proposed rule 25837A should be amended to confirm that the industrial sites with a common boundary with the racecourse are subject to the current time-dependent noise levels in relation to all residential zones other than the proposed residential precinct. I agree with the changes proposed by Mr. Oliver in this respect. The installation of a 4-metre-high fence or bund on the industrial boundaries is the preferred option to a 60-metre setback and would be beneficial in relation to internal noise in habitable rooms and lower levels, and would also serve to reduce the effects of impulsive noise and low frequency noise on the residential buildings. It would also increase outdoor amenity within the residential precinct and the open spaces. A no complaints covenant would have no value from an acoustics point of view. All industrial activities and sites would have to comply with the applicable noise limits, whether or not a covenant is in place. So my recommendations are to update the noise descriptor in the proposed 837E to read early period 15 minutes. Amend the proposed change to rule 25837A to confirm that the industrial sites with a common boundary with the racecourse are subject to the current time-dependent noise levels in relation to all other residential zones other than the residential precinct. Consider including protection from nighttime low-frequency and impulsive noise into the assessment criteria and introduce a rule that would require a 4 metre high acoustic fence along the industrial zone boundary to alternatively construct a bund in the open space, and in either case to require its design and construction to be sufficient to reduce low-frequency noise from the industrial zone. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McGregor. Commissioner Beattie.
Yeah, thank you very much for that, Mr. McGregor. And I'm just interested in your thinking around the 4 metre high wall. And I totally understand your line of logic and I totally understand what you're suggesting. I'm just sort of thinking about that when I think about the height limit in the industrial zone. Given, as I understand it, I think it's 20 metres in height or something. It's higher than 4 metres, is my understanding, is what you could build to in that zone. So what I'm trying to get at is, would a 4 metre high wall deal with things for activities that are on higher levels for, say, in the future that something was built up on a fifth or a sixth level? Or does the wall have to go up as high as the buildings have to go up? You see what I'm trying to say?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, yes, where there's a line of sight between...
Yeah, because that's what you're talking about.
...the source and the receiving environment.
Yeah, and you're using it, it's blocking...
It won't be as effective.
Yeah, so the... The higher the buildings go on the industrial side, the higher the wall would have to go to match it.
That's correct.
Okay, so the 4 metre wall, as you've got it now, sort of based, because our experience of walking on the side is, I think, towards the northern end where signature homes are now, there seemed to be a party wall that came onto the boundary. That was about 4 to 5 metres